WILL Radio. And the program schedule we can provide on this station depends upon meeting our fundraising goal by June 30th. You can still help. If it's time for you to renew your membership in the Friends of WILL, you can go online to will.uiuc.edu and take care of it. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we will take up a topic that we certainly have discussed here before on the program, and that is solar energy. There are a lot of folks who believe that we can and should make greater use of the sun as an energy source, and that if we did that, it would lessen our dependence on fossil fuels and cut down on the problems that are connected with our use of fossil fuels, including the supply issues and pollution. In this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about the state of the solar industry today and about what percentage of America's energy needs might be supplied by the sun. And our guest for the program is Kenneth Zweibel. He is manager of the Thin Films Solar Cell Partnership at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. He has a physics degree from University of Chicago. He's written two books on photovoltaics, the most recent being Harnessing Solar Power, the PV Challenge. He has been at the lab, the National Renewable Energy Lab, in Golden now for 26 years and does, as I said, manage the Thin Film PV Partnership Program there. He also participates frequently in technology assessments in the Department of Energy, and that's the parent of the lab. He's also active in the solar energy policy area, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We invite people to call in, and I know the guest will do his best to answer the questions of the callers. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that no matter where you're listening, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Zweibel, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. For a moment here, probably at the beginning, I ought to ask you to talk a little bit about the National Renewable Energy Laboratory.
NREL, or National Renewable Energy Laboratory, used to be called the Solar Energy Research Institute, or SERI. We were founded about 1977. I came in 1979. In 1977, we were part of the broad approach of the Carter administration. At the height of the oil crises that were so prominent in the 1970s, it was quite a highly charged period in terms of trying to meet energy issues. And so that started the National Renewable Energy Laboratory at that time. Actually, we became a national lab under George Bush, the first one. And we work in all of the renewable areas as solar photovoltaics, which is my specialty, the solar hot water heating, solar concentrating to concentrate sunlight to make steam to produce electricity, biofuels such as ethanol and methanol, and hydrogen production and wind, and basically and distributed power, basically all of the aspects of renewable energy that we'd like to develop to try to meet the various demands of energy supply and pollution issues and climate change.
Mm-hmm. And is the work of the lab all supported by federal money?
Almost all of it is federal money. There is some money, mostly from the Department of Energy, some from the Department of Interior. There is some money from private sources to do collaborative work on specific products, but I'd say 90% of it is federal money. And the federal money is devoted to these kind of long-term challenges, which is an exceptional opportunity, which is rarely possible in our society.
Hmm. I know that people have been thinking about using solar energy as an energy source actually for a long time. There were people that were experimenting with this actually before 1900.
Sure.
But I suppose that people really think about the modern age of solar energy as being roughly 50 years old, dating back to when the first photovoltaics were created in the 50s. So we're not exactly talking at this point about new technology. And I guess the question, whenever we talk about alternatives, alternative energy, renewable sources, the question people always ask is, given the fact that we have been working on this for some time now, why is it that it's not a more fully developed, more well-utilized kind of energy source by this point, by 2005?
I think that's a very good question, and the answer is that photovoltaics per se is based on large areas of semiconductors, square miles. Something familiar you might compare it to would be a flat panel display. A flat panel display sells for about $100 a square foot as far as the semiconductor part of it, the active screen that makes the display. Well, we're forced by the economics of sunlight to go for something like $5 to $10 a square foot. So what the real background of this is that these are extremely challenging technologies that have taken quite a long time of development to bring them down to the cost necessary to make solar economical. The other aspect of that is that sunlight is rather diffuse. It's not like having a reactor that burns coal or something and produces energy. So you need to cover large areas, and to cover large areas, you need something about the cost of a fancy carpet. And making semiconductors jump through that particular hoop is rather challenging. Mm-hmm. So it's taken a long time. And the other side of it is also that there's not been that much demand. I mean, when everybody has cheap energy, cheap electricity, there's not that much of a push to get something new. It's really a global commons issue, something that meets most people's needs but doesn't meet any one person's needs in a way that makes them go out and buy it right now. Mm-hmm. So it's taken a long time, but the good news is we're actually almost right there, and there's a lot of good things happening right now.
So just, I guess, and let me repeat this back to make sure that I've got it. Sort of the bottom line technical issue is this. We know how to take solar energy and make it into electricity. That's not so much the issue.
I Absolutely.
Guess the issue is that how much electricity can you generate and how much surface area, how much solar collector do you need to do that?
Right, and thereby at what cost?
And at what cost? Well, then I guess that brings me to this question: that is what we're looking at here really a technological issue, or is there some matter of physics, some law that you can't get around that says at a certain point there is a limit to how much energy you can expect to get, no matter how good your collector is?
Well, there is always a law of physics in all these things, but the primary one is that there's about 1,000 watts of sunlight at noontime on a sunny day on a square meter of area on the Earth's surface. So that's basically what you start with. And then you lose some of that in the conversion process, and we have efficiencies of conversion that go from 10% to almost 40%. So we're getting 100 watts to 400 watts per square meter. That tends to define your economics. If you can pay for that square meter, making that square meter of semiconductor to get 100 to 400 watts over the course of a year, so to speak, in terms of the sunlight, then you can afford that, and that's what you go for, and that defines the cost that you can afford in making these things. So it's a combination of cost and conversion of sunlight efficiency, and that's what we've been working on. And there is another side to it, though. Time is one thing, but money is the other. And I often smile to myself when I hear this question, and I hear it quite often, because if you give a technology no money and take 400 years, it won't get anywhere. So you need money as well as time. And because of the lack of a market, because the cost of electricity was so low and there was no societal driver, few societal drivers to get people to spend money on this in advance, there was not much pushing it. It's only really been in the last 5 or 10 years with the awareness of climate change as an issue And the progress in photovoltaics, or PV we can call it to make it simple, that has come together, that there's been much greater progress, and there's a tremendous amount of progress, unfortunately most of it in terms of markets in Europe and Japan, but it's really driving the whole world's photovoltaic industry.
Well, let me show one more question, and I have a caller here who is on hold, and I want to tell that person I will not make them wait forever, just make one further point, and that is, maybe you could talk for a moment or two about what your thinking is about what percentage of our energy needs this could supply. And I guess I think about the people who have said, well, solar is a great thing and nothing against it. But when you consider how much energy we use and how much energy this technology is capable of generating for us, that you'd virtually have to cover the whole entire United States with solar collectors to generate enough electricity to make even a dent in our overall energy use. And I'm sure you've heard people make this, tell that same
concern. It's kind of a misconception that people have, and the good news is it's starting to be fixed. But there's about 10,000 times more sunlight coming onto the Earth's surface than we use in terms of energy. And what it turns out is that if you use 0.3% of the United States land area, that it would produce all of our electricity, every kilowatt hour we currently produce. And if you use 1.1%, it would produce all of our energy, including transportation and heat. So these are relatively small amounts. In fact, I often compare this with the military bases and bombing ranges. They're over 1% of the United States land area. And unless you happen to live next to one, you usually don't even notice them. So that's the same with PV. And if you put PV on roofs, you also wouldn't be using new land. The simple answer is that there's much, much more solar energy than we need to produce all of our energy. And with solar being able to put on rooftops and with a small amount of area that we'll use, it won't impact anybody's perception of land use and won't be cutting down anybody's forests.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kenneth Zweibel. He's manager of the Thin Films Solar Cell Partnership at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. And we're talking about solar energy. And if you have questions, you can call us. I know he'll do his best to take on your question. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Urbana. We'll talk to them right now. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've been interested in solar energy since my seventh grade science project in which I cooked hamburger meat in a solar oven. I'm sure that the technology has come a long way since then. But I was wondering if you could update us on where things stand on the new Apollo initiative, which would give $30 billion a year to research and development of alternative energy. And also if you could inform your listeners of what kinds of things that we can do to take advantage of solar energy at an individual level, and I'll listen offline.
Okay.
I have to say that before you leave, I'll have to ask you what the Apollo initiative is. I think I've heard of something informal that people were trying to do to bring together the focus on solar energy to try to make it an Apollo-like mission. So I'm assuming this is not a government program because I haven't heard of it as a government program. Is that right?
I'm afraid the caller has rung off, so I can't tell you. Either she can call back or maybe somebody else can tell us.
Let me guess that that's what it is because I've heard of such a thing, and what it was an attempt to gather people's awareness about this issue so that it could become an important enough issue politically that the federal government would up the ante on development. And I think that it's a very good idea. It's a very appropriate idea. And some people in academia, others outside of the government, have said that, including Richard Smalley, a Nobel Prize winner from Rice, and Nate Lewis, a scientist from Berkeley, that energy and climate change are our biggest challenges of the 21st century. And that we're missing out on these issues, we're letting them lag, and that we need to develop an Apollo-like or Manhattan Project-like mission at the federal level to try to address them. And I think that's right. And I think it's a defensible position, and I'd be happy to talk about it if other listeners are interested.
Well, this just now I'm on my computer here on the internet, and I do find a website for something called the Apollo Alliance, mm-hmm. and that is indeed apparently what it is. It is they say that it's a broad coalition within the labor, environmental, business, urban, and faith communities in support of good jobs and energy independence, and then goes on and they talk about what it is they're interested in. And I think that again, what you say is correct, that in calling it the Apollo Alliance, they're invoking that as a metaphor of the kind of effort that they think we should put behind developing a new kind of energy policy. And if people have internet access, all they have to do is go to www.apolloalliance.org, and they will find out everything they'd want to know.
Yeah, this has been an interesting problem for us over the last 30 years. And that I mentioned this earlier, the global commons aspect. If you have cheap electricity and you plug your TV into the wall and you're happy, why develop alternative energy? It's not a normal driver coming from the private industry, as much as we would like to believe it is. So in many cases, the drivers for developing alternative energy, specifically photovoltaics, have come from governments and very long-range visionaries, a few very long-range visionaries, and in private industry. And the Europeans and the Japanese have moved to another level, about an order of magnitude more money being spent on this, because they have greater energy issues. The Japanese import just about all of their oil. The Europeans are very worried about climate change because of the Gulf Stream. So they have a lot more concern, and that drives a political change. In the United States, we're fortunate to have very low-cost energy, but that makes us more complacent. So we're in a sense dependent right now on others like the Europeans and the Japanese to drive these technologies, and the good news is they are, and that's meaning that they're buying enough that the costs are coming down. As we've learned to expect, the initial costs are high, but as you get some market volume, the costs come down, and that's happening. And it's an extremely fulfilling experience for someone like me who's been in this business for over a quarter of a century and been waiting for something like this. So the time is ripe, and things really are happening. It's just a kind of a question of whether the United States will actually participate at the same level.
Hmm. I think for some time now, there has been a maybe low level but fairly consistent kind of interest among people who do home design and construction in employing passive solar in home design. But I wonder, it seemed like there was a time when people were interested in experimenting with active solar. There were people who had solar collectors on the roofs of their houses. A lot of these, I think, maybe were kind of do-it-yourself sort of things, and that over time, a lot of those seem to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of potential is there for active solar on the individual level of, say, an individual home?
Well, the solar technologies that we're talking about here are, for a home user, are both the more familiar, perhaps, hot water heating technology, which is basically a conversion of light into heat with a dark-colored absorber, and the photovoltaic technology, which converts the light directly into DC electricity. There were no PV collectors back in the 1970s and 80s. They just weren't there because the technology wasn't ready. And I think part of the problem is the confusion that many people have between those technologies, that it was there and then it went away, and then is it coming back? Well, PV was never there. But solar thermal certainly was there and is coming back, especially in the warmer climates. Israel has very large percentage of solar hot waters on roofs. I believe California is moving in that direction. The photovoltaics is what's taking off in Europe and Japan, and we passed 1 gigawatt a year of sales last year, which is a nuclear power plant in size. So this is no longer the solar beanie type of number. And I've done calculations that show with the kind of growth rate, last year PV growth grew 50%, 53%, and it's grown over 40% a year for the last 5 years. With growth of only 30%, we can soon get to the kind of gigawatts of installed PV that it takes to start impacting our energy use in America much sooner than people think.
Well, that actually, real quickly, and again, I have some other callers, but that gets at another issue, and that is the potential of solar and other renewables to become viable industries here in the United States, generating jobs and also creating products that we can sell to other countries. And I think there are a lot of people who say that and have been saying for some time that there's real potential here and that other countries are getting out ahead of us, and we're missing the boat here by not being more serious about investing in developing this technology as a viable commercial product.
That's right. Examples of some exciting things happening in the Midwest are that there are two companies, one in Michigan called Unisolar and one in Ohio called First Solar, that are on Lake Erie, that are tripling their capacity right now as we speak in some new technologies in photovoltaics and bringing in hundreds of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars of sales. And this is the tip of the iceberg. But we've been fortunate that we actually still lead the world in technology development. That's something that we might pat ourselves on the back about, but unfortunately, the rest of the world, because they see the value more clearly than we do, because they're incorporating more systems, are buying our technology. So what's the next few years may show that many of the leading companies that we still have will be bought out by Europeans and Japanese, and that will undercut our position as being able to produce a lot of jobs and a lot of energy in our own country. We have the chance to domesticate the energy that we're importing. We have the chance to convert ourselves from being dependent on importing energy to being able to produce a good portion of it, keep the jobs here, and use the energy in a distributed way that's fair in our own country. These are paradigm shifts. And the sad truth is that not that many people really know it, and it could really change our whole world.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have somebody on a cell phone, and that's line number one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you very much for letting me have a question here. At one time, there was a great deal of interest in the photosynthesis that goes on with leaves and the chlorophyll, et cetera. And I was wondering what progress has been made along that area and how that potentially is contributing.
It's an interesting area and remains an interesting area, and it's very hard to actually imitate nature. One of the things nature does that's very good is it repairs itself. And so the way that photosynthesis works is so subtle and so much dependent on that self-repairing aspect that it's been very hard to imitate. We essentially know that we have to do better than photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is about 0.5% efficient. Photovoltaics starts at about 10% and goes up from there. That's why the land area issue for photovoltaics is very attractive, much better than almost any other renewable alternative. But photosynthesis still remains an interesting area because we learn a lot about conversion. And there's an interest as well in developing hydrogen splitting, water splitting to produce hydrogen, and even the possibility of synthesizing carbohydrate-like substance called hydrocarbons. So those are attractive type of endpoints. So there will be continued research in those areas, but as far as contributing to the near term, I think we'll have to depend on the farmers and the biomass producers to be able to contribute in the traditional fashion.
I see. All right. Well, the whole thing about the hydrogen and splitting that with I believe it's called electrolysis, if I'm not mistaken, is that correct?
Right.
When you use electrolysis, has often interested me. I don't know why they don't use more excess electricity, such as on peak times, start that generation, or are they already doing that?
And that's a very smart observation. I think that the off-peak nuclear and some other off-peaks might be one of the ways to go towards the short term in terms of the hydrogen economy. Of course, if you start building more nuclear power plants, you bring up a whole new set of issues. We're trying to bring the cost of solar down so that the DC electricity from solar can then be used in electrolyzers to split water to produce hydrogen. The hydrogen economy is kind of a gleam in the distance that many of us would like to get to. Of course, it has some of its own issues, mostly transportation and storage of hydrogen. But it is an attractive, non-polluting approach, and the real source of energy that will have to be used if we don't use nuclear, or if we don't go back to just using more fossil fuels, would be solar. And for that to happen, solar has to come down in price, and that's the whole name of the game for solar. So we're on the same path. It's just a matter of a stair step of markets. First market we go for is the rooftop market in houses and commercial buildings, because that's a retail electricity, and it essentially turns the meter backwards, and you save your 12 cents a kilowatt hour or whatever you're paying to your utility. The next markets after that we go for is distributed markets, where we're supporting utility distribution of electricity in the weaker parts of the grid where new voltage and electricity would be appropriate, especially during peak times during the day. And solar is fortunate because it does match most peaks, because summer peaks are air conditioning peaks. So that's a felicitous coincidence. And then after that, we start going towards larger systems and centralized systems in the many gigawatts, and that also requires another reduction in cost. And then after that, we go for production of electricity to be stored or to produce fuels, and that requires another reduction in cost. So this theme of cost reduction, manufacturing cost reduction, will be with us for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years as solar goes through all these market niches, market stair steps.
It seems that the hope was that we would have these generating places like you're talking about, but with wind, I understand that there's been some negative political reaction from companies, the power companies, that when you generate this power on a farm, for example, they don't want to pay you the same rate for the energy that you're being charged for the energy when you use it.
Right. That's definitely a political and economic question, and there are arguments on both sides. There have been studies that show that if you have it on a residential PV on a residential rooftop, that you deserve the full retail price or close to it. Certainly there are costs incurred by the utility to distribute electricity, and when you use the grid as a backup, which is what you're doing when you put PV on a rooftop, there's some charge that you should incur for that availability of that backup. So those are refinements, and I think that what we'll find is that as we go through 5%, 10%, 20% of total electricity, that those things will start to evolve towards a fair level playing field. But during the same time, photovoltaics will be coming down in price as technology improves and as the volume increases. So I think we'll be able to meet those challenges, just as we've met the challenge of coming down a thousandfold already from when PV was used to power the Vanguard space satellite in 1958 to now when we want to use it to make the same kind of electricity that we get from the plug that we're used to in our wall socket.
Thank you for your work and for your knowledge.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
We're just
call.
A little bit past the midpoint here. I have two other callers we'll get right to, but I do want to introduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 15, 20 minutes. We're talking with Ken Zweibel. He works at the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, and has been there for 26 years. He now manages the Thin Film PV Partnership Program there. He has written two books on photovoltaics. The most recent is Harnessing Solar Power, the PV Challenge. And we're talking about solar energy. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Also, toll free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here, and the next is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I missed a little bit of the front end of the show, so if you may have already brought this up, but two things basically. One, I remember seeing a PBS, I think it was that, or either a Discovery Channel show, where they were interviewing this scientist and going through his plant where he developed a thin film photovoltaic or at least some kind of photosynthetic collector that was a lot cheaper than the traditional photo cell, but that while it wasn't as efficient at the sunniest part of the day, it actually on like cloudy days or non-peak times was actually more efficient than the traditional photocells. And I guess I'd like to know what you know or about that and how that may be part of the equation. And secondly, I remember Ralph Nader once saying that if you could meter the sun, we would have had solar energy yesterday. And that in mind, do you find that the Bush-Cheney administration, given their background, is actively hostile to the development of solar technology, or are they just clueless as to the potential and the importance of working on this?
Those are two very different questions. Let's start with the first one. Basically, I've been trying to explain that solar energy depends on two things. One is the conversion efficiency, which is the amount of output per unit area of electricity from sunlight. And the other one is the cost per unit area. And when you combine those, you get the cost per unit area divided by the output, you get the cost per watt, which becomes the measure of economics. And what you saw probably on PBS was someone who had a very cheap way to make a converter of solar energy, but it didn't make very much energy. And unfortunately, you need both. And that's a very, very hard lesson we've all learned and it's become a part of our lives who work in this field. We love the technologies that are very cheap to make, but they have to be efficient. And there are, you mentioned the term thin films. There are some thin films. In fact, the two major facilities I talked about that are putting hundreds of jobs in Ohio and Michigan are thin film companies. They're new technologies. They're where we lead the world. And that's a very good channel for U.S. development, for U.S. success. So thin films are real and are relatively lower efficiency but very cheap to make. So that's an example of what you're talking about, and that is a main part of what we're doing. The other question, I've tried to answer a little bit about in terms of public awareness. There is real reason why the Japanese are aware of energy because they import almost all their oil. There's real reason why the Europeans are concerned about alternative energy because they're worried about climate change. The United States is fortunate to have relatively inexpensive energy. That means people are less concerned. It really is as simple as that, and then if you impose on that the politics of the different parties, you get a little bit of a push one way and you get a little bit of a push the other way, but it really isn't the overwhelming difference. The overwhelming difference is public awareness, and this kind of show is what it would take to bring public awareness around. But I do think that the kind of successes in Michigan and Ohio, which were funded by the Department of Energy over the last 25 years in Democrat and Republican administrations, are the kind of things that any administration could start to celebrate and start to become aware that the idea of leading in technology is actually true. That's actually the way the United States does succeed, and we are leading in these technologies. And we could succeed in becoming the leader in photovoltaics and solar if we wanted to enough to actually do it. And I'm a little surprised that hasn't happened. I think it's a real opportunity.
Well, I think the current administration has a lot of reasons why they're much more interested in oil. And it's more than just an energy source. It's, for them, I think it's also a way of a political tool that they can use to get their way in the world, but hopefully that won't last much longer. Thanks.
All right,
sure, and I will say that the kind of money that we spend, and perhaps rightfully spend, in the Middle East, because there are all kinds of complications and issues there, but that kind of money could make photovoltaics cost-effective over a 10-year period or so just by a market pull program. One year's worth of that money, say $100 billion. So I think really if people knew that we could change our whole energy infrastructure, we could have another way of making electricity and another way of making energy, and it would change our world and our world politics, they would do it. But I think that we still live a little bit in the solar beanie age, where people don't take photovoltaics or solar very seriously. They don't see it as a real energy source, and so they're not motivated to act. But I think that will change.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This also is a listener in Champaign, and it's line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
3 issues. The first one, before the phone call, the guest was speaking about passive solar houses, and it probably is of interest to listeners that there is a pioneering effort right here in Champaign-Urbana that, David, you might be able to pull it up on your computer. I think the address is www.eco-lab.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is following on from the so-called passive house efforts in Germany. The lady architect is from Germany. They have built one house in East Urbana, and they're working on another. And the achievement is well beyond the LEED efforts. The house that exists saves about 85% of its energy.
Yeah, she has actually been on Focus 580, although it's probably been a couple of years.
Oh, she has been?
Yes.
Oh, well, wonderful.
Yes.
Okay, the second thing I thought I'd mention was, as Amory Lovins of Rocky Mountain Institute has pointed out in his book, with many others, small is profitable. The generation of energy by photovoltaics and other small energy alternative producers, production methods, when combined with some other things, really changes the whole energy picture. If you produce by photovoltaics in small amounts in distributed locations and combine that with using a great deal more efficient things, like even the simple compact fluorescent bulbs, it allows you to produce the energy much closer to where it's used so that you don't depend so much on the grid. And that means that you save an awful lot on transmission so that you don't need to generate as much energy in order to get as much end use.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing I would ask the guest, your laboratory has been in existence for about a quarter century, and some people might think this has been an awful lot of federal expenditure for so far, not a great deal that we've been using in the United States. But I wonder if you could give a quick ratio to how much federal money has been spent in efforts like yours as contrasted with the amount that's gone into the development of fission and fusion as an energy source.
Yes, those are very apt comparisons. And I don't have the numbers for the nuclear development, and I certainly don't know what all of the less obvious supports in terms of insurance and things like that and waste disposal and stuff like that. But I would say that it would be 1 to 2 orders of magnitude higher in terms of support for nuclear than it has been for solar energy. Our budget for the photovoltaics is about $75 million a year from the Department of Energy, and it's come up from a low of about $35 million during the early 80s. In the late 70s, it was as high as $150 million. The Europeans are spending, I would say, let me estimate here, somewhere between $200 million and $1 billion a year right now on support for solar installations, market pull type of approach rather than a market push approach. We have generally the R&D approach, which is a market push approach, and some of the states are developing market pull approaches, which I think are quite attractive, like California and Arizona. Actually, many states have these, and I think that's quite a tribute to the grassroots people who have brought these things to success. That's something they should really be appreciated for. But another comparison I make is how much it pays. We're talking about producing something like, let's say, 100 gigawatts over 15 years in terms of where we're going from here. And that's easily $100 billion, probably a little more than that. But the investment that we've made in the technologies to date have probably been under $1 billion total and probably under $100 million for individual technologies. So we're talking about payoffs here of two orders of magnitude and just the beginning of changing the world in terms of its the way it produces energy and the way it suffers or doesn't suffer from pollution. So as I said before, it's very hard. It takes a long time when you don't have any money to do something.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Let's continue, and we'll go to next someone in. Let me see, what line am I going to? We're going to line number one in Urbana. There we go. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
All this talk makes me has gotten me organized to change the sheets, stick them in the washing machine. I'm going to hang them out in my solar clothes dryer. Something that a lot of people have access to or could have access to if they set one up in their yard. Of course, if you have an apartment building and don't have a balcony or something, it doesn't work. And if your schedule doesn't happen to work with the rain schedule, mine happens too today. So I just wanted to add that one little bit that we could all think about, or many of us could think about doing to do our cumulative efforts toward using solar power. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Well, let's go on here to another call. This is somebody on a cell phone. It's line number two. Hello.
I heard an odd statistic one time, and I have no idea how accurate or inaccurate it is, but someone was talking about comparing how many square miles of photovoltaics we need to be able to supplant our electricity needs using photovoltaics. Do you have any idea of surface area relationships along those lines?
Right. I try to make comparisons that are tangible so people can get it. To produce every kilowatt hour of electricity in the United States would take 0.3% of the U.S. land area. To produce every joule of energy in the United States, including transportation and heating, would take 1.1% of our land area. Right now, we use 1% of our land area for military bases. Most people don't even know where their nearest military base is. If you don't live next to one, you might not even notice it. So the point is, we're not talking about changing the way we use land. In fact, farm set-aside land in the Midwest probably could meet almost all of our electricity needs all by itself. I don't have that number on the tip of my tongue. I think it's about 10 million acres to meet all the photovoltaic needs. So the opportunity is obvious, but the problem is that people have a really old-fashioned idea. And I'm not blaming the caller. I mean, this is absolutely the first question on the tip of everybody's tongue. Have a really old-fashioned idea of how much area it takes and what the impact of that area would be. Sometimes I read an article recently in The New Yorker, and to make it sound scary, they said the size of the state of Connecticut. Someone else said the size of the state of New Hampshire. I'm not sure if those are exactly accurate. But if you live in a city, you tend to underestimate the amount of area out here in the rest of the United States. These are minuscule amounts of area from the United States standpoint. And if you live in a city and you want to use PV, put it on your roof. You don't need to use any forest or your backyard.
You know, it seems with an attitude like that, probably the horizontal surface area of the roofs that we have already in this country might be sufficient to be able to accommodate that requirement.
You know, I haven't added up all those numbers, but it does make a substantial impact. And I suspect it would meet at least as much energy as nuclear power meets. Perhaps double or triple that. That would be my off-the-top-of-the-head estimate. And that doesn't add any land.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And that does get to the question of how, if we could get to gear up to the point where photovoltaics could be supplying our energy needs or some part of them, whether we would be more likely to see this happen as large solar farms as, in effect, a kind of a solar-powered commercial power plant, or whether really it makes more sense to think about this as applications on specific buildings like homes, or you can imagine them on factories, on office buildings, and that then that building would be collecting and producing energy for that building.
Yeah, those are very good questions, and basically it's this stair step of markets. We want to start out with those retail markets such as roofs and commercial buildings and even building facades. But we also want to do large fields called distributed power, which can be located anywhere in the United States, and eventually much, much larger fields, and perhaps even concentrated fields of gigawatts or more in the Southwest, which has about 25% more sunlight than, say, Illinois per year, and gain some value from that and even produce hydrogen or produce stored electricity. So there will be a stair step of these things, and we'll see all of them. And nobody will have to feel that their way of doing it is going to be ignored. It's going to be plenty. There are going to be plenty of rooftops. And some of these new thin films have beautiful aesthetic roofing material that looks just like a roof shingle. So it doesn't have to look like a clunky solar collector. It can look attractive. The neighbor who you want to talk to about it, you can talk to about it. And the neighbor who you don't want to know about it doesn't even have to know it's there.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I found myself wondering about was if we could develop these kind of technologies so we had these very thin, lightweight collectors, whether you could get to the point where not only was your roof a solar collector, but your entire house could be one, or you could the outside of your car could be one. Or then I started, I don't know if this is too wild, I started thinking, well, let's make it into a coat. And you could wear it, and maybe you could plug your laptop into it. I mean, I don't know if such a thing would be possible, but it's my imagination got a little wild there. What sort of potential is there for something close to that?
Well, essentially, what you're talking about is that as we get used to the opportunity to use solar power, we will start to let it become part of most of the things that we do. So that, yes, we would put it naturally when we build a new house on the roof and on the southern-facing side of the house, if it's appropriate in terms of the attractiveness. And I think that it can be, and it has been done on buildings. It can be extremely attractive on skyscrapers and on cityscapes. So, yes, those things will all happen. Some people have even thought about using it built into sidewalks and pavements under a protective surface. So there are any number of ways this thing will be used. It can replace windows. It can be partially transparent so that you still have light, but some portion of that light is being used for electricity. Hmm. So all this will happen as we become used to the opportunity for using this stuff.
Now, I guess one of the questions we're coming down to by our last 3-4 minutes, though. One of the questions that we have not touched on is the kind of resources that we need to build these things. And I guess I'm thinking about raw materials, and there are some rather special items that we would need. Do we indeed have all the appropriate building blocks? If we decided we were going to do that and we were going to move into the direction of having solar photovoltaics as common and as widespread in the environment as you just talked about, would we in fact have all of the materials that we would need to make them?
We recently did a study on the same question, and it was basically for meeting a terawatt type of level of energy, which is to say the United States produces 3 terawatts, so a terawatt is a lot of energy. And so we were trying to meet something between 10 and 20 terawatts globally, which would offset CO2 production by 2050. That's the kind of challenge we're facing. And we looked at the materials, and they're basically a lot of glass, steel, and plastic, which are fairly easy to scale up in terms of growth over a 50-year period. Glass was the most challenging, but even that had less than 3% a year growth. So I think the glass companies would love it. The other ones are the specific materials of either silicon or the raw materials of the thin film devices. And in some cases, there are issues there. And there's especially issues of mismatch between the amount of refining capacity that exists and the amount of need, if the need grows explosively. So there will be some distortions having to do with explosive growth and the need of some of these specialty elements for semiconductor materials. But there are enough diversity of these technologies that, and there is enough, I think, stimulus from the markets that will come about from these technologies that I think we will address those needs as we go along. But they will become part and parcel of this development process, and it would be wrong to believe that you could change the world's biggest industry, which is the energy industry, without impacting some of these issues as we go along. Mm.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, one of the callers referenced the fact that you've been doing this kind of work, or at least you've been at the lab there in Golden for 26 years. How much longer do you think that we should expect it to take before we start seeing some really, before we really see this photovoltaics
right.
really taken off?
I think the good news is that in Europe, they're already starting to see it, just like they already see it for wind. They're seeing it. They're starting to see it for photovoltaics. In the United States, I'd say we're 3 to 5 years behind the Europeans and the Japanese, but we will start to get some kind of experience of what's happening. Something's happening here. Something's happening elsewhere that we're not really very good at. Maybe we ought to start thinking about this. I think the solar age is actually here right now. It's here in Europe and Japan, and that's a big part of the world. It's here in Southeast Asia. Actually, it's here in the United States. It's just that not enough of us know about it.
Well, at that, I think we'll have to leave it for this time around, with the promise that I'm sure we'll get back to this issue. And also in the future here, we're planning on trying to talk a little bit more on Focus 580 about energy issues. And certainly we'll be talking about renewables. We're planning on doing a program sometime soon talking about wind power. And of course, people have other kinds of suggestions or ideas on what we might talk about. Well, that's great. We're always happy to have them. Our guest this morning, Ken Zweibel, he works at the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory, that's in Golden, Colorado, and manages the Thin Film PV Partnership Program there. They do have a website, and if you're interested in finding out about the lab and its activities, you can get on the internet and put it in your search engine, and you will find it. And Mr. Zweibel, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible today by Active Seniors Options, presenting their Senior Expo Flair 2005, Passport to Active Living. That'll be held on Friday, May 20th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Interstate Center in Bloomington. Expo Flair 2005 will feature entertainment and activities for seniors and their families, including wellness screenings, seminars, informative exhibits, and drawings. More information is available at www.expoflair.com. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the afternoon magazine, we'll look at Rwanda and the aftermath of the genocide of 1994 that resulted in the deaths of more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. The guest for the show will be journalist Dina Temple Raston. She's the author of a newly published book, Justice on the Grass: Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial, and a Nation's Quest for Redemption. She'll be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. Coming up here, we're going to take a break. We'll have news from National Public Radio 1 minute past the hour. And then after that, we will be talking with author of a recent book titled Testosterone Dreams, looking at the presence and popularity of synthetic testosterone in our culture. His name is John Hoberman. Before that, we'll be taking a break, and we'll have an update here for you on the markets.